The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, everybody. We're going to begin our fourth and final segment, or at least panel segment, this afternoon. And I appreciate everyone's kind attention and your hanging in with us with your nice questions and the like. This is a panel that has been presaged somewhat by what we talked about in connection with the last panel, the development of international transparency, other nations of the world poised and then coming up with their own FOIA and then having to implement it and effectively enforcement thereafter. And the question raised, or one of the questions raised by this panel, is the U.S.'s role in the world, how it has changed somewhat, perhaps in recent years, perhaps going back more than a decade, and whether it can continue or how it can continue to exert leadership in the international transparency realm. And we have two speakers who are very well positioned, I think, to speak to this. The first is Daniel Alcorn, who's been a very active, I would dare even say prolific litigator of Freedom Information Act cases. Although I don't think the word prolific is the most commonly used euphemism within government agencies, perhaps. But a very active and prolific litigator of Freedom Information Act lawsuits, quite successfully, I might say, from his perspective, both here in D.C. in the District Court and in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And that has led to a number of precedents that are cited by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which everyone knows, of course, is the circuit of universal venue for FOIA cases. And during that time, he has also seen the development and been a keen observer of the development of international transparency law, of the adoption of freedom of information laws overseas, and is someone who has very strong views about that and about the importance of transparency in multiple respects. And then, you know, Dan Alcorn is to my far left. I know I've used that one before. And to my left as well is Mr. Hugo Tufel. I'm sorry, there's no room on the right. There's no space whatsoever.
I'm here. There is no room on the right.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Turn around and face the wall.
Hugo Tufel is someone who holds an appointment at the cabinet secretary level right now. He's both the chief privacy officer and chief freedom of information officer at the newest of the 15 cabinet departments in the federal government. As we all know, there are 92 federal agencies subject to the FOIA. There are 15 cabinet departments and 77 other agencies. I haven't checked today to see if we're down to 91, but I think it is 92 total. And that newest one, of course, is the Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Tufel was appointed to that position by Secretary Michael Chertoff back in the summer of 2006. And just on a personal note, I had the pleasure of calling him, I believe it was the morning that he began that job. And the expression was that his cushion had not even been dented yet. And I said, Hugo, I'm just giving you a heads up. I'm testifying before the House FOIA Subcommittee 2 days from now on Wednesday the 26th. And they're going to be looking for something from DHS, and I can only hold them off so long. And on that first day on the job, if I remember correctly, I think it was by about 11:30 that night, Hugo himself without his people, I never really learned for sure, had the executive order report from DHS over to the government accounting office such that they, when they testified on Wednesday, GAO could not damn DHS as much as GAO would have otherwise. So that was a major success that Hugo had on his first day on that job. But all seriousness aside, before he was at DHS, he also held a high-level position as litigation supervisor, a litigation manager, an associate solicitor at the Department of the Interior, and prior to that served in state government and in private practice, and he was also a clerk way back for Judge Lauren Smith of the U.S. Claims Court, and you can tell how long ago that was, because it's not called the U.S. Claims Court any longer. But among all of his credentials, by far and away, the one that I think is most significant was that he was also, back in the day, the senior articles editor of the Administrative Law Journal. And those of you who are very assiduous, careful, attention-paying students here at the Washington College of Law know that is a law journal published by this law school, and indeed, Hugo Tuffel is a proud alum of the Washington College of Law. So, in addition to introducing him together with Dan, I'm very pleased to welcome him back home as well.
Dan, thank you so much for your invitation here. I wanted to introduce in the audience the true originator of that prolific litigation, and that's Jim Lazar. And Jim is truly prolific in his FOIA litigation, and I've only done a little part.
I can just add to that, that as someone who personally delivered a litigation filing to his home at about midnight in May of 1978, now more than 30 years ago, I can attest to that, to his longevity as well. That was just on a little case involving the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. That had bore the name of Lazar versus Department of Justice, in fact.
As I was preparing for this talk, all the news discussion was about the market turmoil, and I couldn't help but following the discussion, because so much of the discussion about the market centered around transparency and the lack of transparency in the market. And I began to pay more attention, did some research on that, because it was so interesting in preparing for today's discussion. And I found that expert opinion on the market situation is almost unanimous, in fact, unanimous in what I've seen, in saying that lack of transparency and opaqueness have been major causative factors in the market turmoil that we see today. I brought a copy of the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, also known as the bailout bill, that I printed off on the internet because it was put on the internet last night for all to see. And it has a transparency provision that I'm going to go through that addresses transparency, but I have the sad news to inform you that I understand the House defeated the bill today.
Yes.
Vote of what, 220?
I think it was something like 218, 220 to 205.
I think it was 228 to
228. 228 to
225. So this bill is not operative at this point, and apparently the market has reacted very badly to the events today.
What website, just
to address it, what did you print it off on? The Joint Economic Committee, the House Joint Economic Committee website. And actually, one of the things I read in the paper yesterday was that Speaker Pelosi said that the bill would be put on the internet for one day before the vote, and I did find it on the internet last night. And this is an example of some of the emerging changes that we're having in the idea of government transparency.
I'm not sure that's actually it, because I heard on the radio coming over here that it's now up to 120 pages. That doesn't look quite 120 pages.
This is 110 pages,
okay.
I can assure you. but it gives you some idea of some of the changes that are happening, coming along in transparency. One is using the internet to inform the public of bills of importance that are pending, and that Nancy Pelosi said she would give a day, and obviously that's not a lot of time, but it is some disclosure. The provision itself has a transparency provision, section 114, and it required, if it had passed, and maybe some version will pass in the future, the Secretary of the Treasury, if he uses the money to buy various instruments, he must post on the internet within two business days of purchase, or post electronically within two business days of purchase, the fact of the purchase. So there's some disclosure provision there. And there's an interesting provision that if the Secretary of the Treasury were to use this authority then the secretary shall determine whether the public disclosure required for such financial institutions with respect to off-balance sheet transactions, derivative instruments, contingent liabilities, similar sources of potential exposure, is adequate to provide to the public sufficient information as to the true financial position of institutions. If such disclosure is not adequate for that purpose, the secretary shall make recommendations for additional disclosure requirements to the relevant regulators. This is an indication of the concern about a lack of transparency, a lack of disclosure that underlies the current problems in the market. And the stated theory is that the market mechanism to set prices only works with adequate transparency and adequate disclosure. And so I found that very interesting in our topic of international transparency, because here we have emerging this crisis atmosphere in which transparency is a key issue. And I think in this situation, the U.S. has no choice but to lead on this issue. We're going to have to lead on this. We have the largest economy in the world. Our markets are the ones in the leading markets in the world. The rest of the world is looking to us. And so as we work through this problem, and as this transparency issue is addressed, I have no doubt that the United States will be in the lead, and the rest of the world will be, I'm sure, watching with great interest as to what we're able to do with the situation. And that's just the lead-in from my thought. I think it's natural that the United States would take a leadership role on the issue of transparency. My understanding of the order of adoption of freedom of information statutes is that the United States was third. Now, there's always some argument about this, but my understanding is Sweden was first, perhaps in their constitution of 1766.
1766, a statute.
And in Sweden, and Finland adopted a FOIA provision in 1951. The United States adopted our FOIA in 1966 and became effective a year later in 1967, and then other countries followed. And what I take from that chronology is that the United States was the first major power, certainly the first superpower, to adopt a freedom of information transparency system. And so to me, it is a natural position that the U.S. would be in to be a leader in transparency and in freedom of information. In listening to the presentations earlier today, we were reminded of some of the developments around the world, how some nations have moved forward and adopted even more modernized systems of freedom of information. And my point is to say that as we maintain a leadership role, or if we seek a leadership role, I think we need to keep abreast of what these other nations are doing and how the FOIA systems are being improved as other systems consider them. And I think we may want to consider incorporating into the U.S. system some of the innovations that have been prepared internationally so that we could have a better functioning, better operating system as we go forward. Some of the ideas that I heard mentioned were the ombudsman proposal. I don't think anyone is too happy with our litigation system. Jim has me in cases as counsel that were filed in 1988, and they're still pending in the U.S. District Court freedom of information cases. I don't think that's a prompt resolution of one's case. And so I think an ombudsman proposal is a possibility. Some systems in other countries cover legislative and judicial branches as well. We don't have a congressional freedom of information. That's something we may want to consider, or the Congress may want to consider. The judicial branch, we have a pretty open system, but there's more and more secrecy occurring in our courts as there are more and more security cases that go through the courts. And so there are issues there, and there are also issues as to personal interest of judges and those kinds of issues that we may want to consider. I heard the suggestion of the public interest override provision. We don't have a strict public interest override provision.
We have it in the privacy exemptions 6 and 7C, but not really in any other exemption.
Well, you have it theoretically under exemption 1 because of the provision in the executive order, but it has never been applied.
The emphasis in that sentence should be on the word theoretically.
And so I heard the suggestion, I think one of the nations was in India, that had a public interest override provision that could override any FOIA provision if the public interest were strong enough.
England, too, has an enormous infusion of override dynamic within its stature.
We heard of Mexico's system, which was very well received, in which all documents released to any requester are placed on the internet and available by World Wide Web. And so, therefore, any documents released to anyone would be available to all on the internet, and these are Freedom of Information documents. And that would, I think, be an improvement over what we have. There's the whole issue of contractors and others who do a lot of federal work but are not strictly covered by Freedom of Information. There's certainly an issue there. We have the technological improvements that are occurring. Many of these improvements in other nations are brought about by the changes in information technology that make the internet available and the ability to post documents. And I think we've only really begun to incorporate those technological changes into what the government can do in its disclosure function. I heard Kristen Adair in the first session talk about how disclosure should be the norm, should really be the norm, and should be done proactively. And the freedom of information, the request system, or the idea of the request, and certainly litigation or pursuing the, it should be a very rare event, should only be about really contested matters. And there would be some way to set up a system that would be more proactive in disclosure, making more things available on the internet, and not require people to make requests and pursue them in court. There's a lot of discussion occurring about the interactive relationship now that's possible between the public and the government, or between the public and politicians. I think the posting of this bill on the internet is an example of that, that now it's possible to put the information right out to the public in real time as it's being considered in the legislative process or in the White House process for bill signing. There are all the techniques that the internet makes available of soliciting opinion and ideas from the public, and that are being used so effectively by people in their political campaigns to engage many more people in the political process. And I think a lot of people are doing thinking about how can those technologies be incorporated not just in business or political campaigning, but into the governance process to provide more of a connection between the public and the politicians, and more information to the public, and ability for the public to give feedback to the public officials as they go about their decision-making process. And the open government groups have some ideas that they're putting forward for a new administration in the field of freedom of information. There's a desire to restore the preference for disclosure by executive direction and by replacing the Ashcroft Memorandum of October 10th, 2001, I think is 12th. The day. 12th. And desire is to have a preference in the system for disclosure if reasonable harm is not foreseen by release. And the Ashcroft Memo is more of a direction that the Justice Department will defend withholdings if there's an arguable reason to defend the withholdings. There's an issue of adequate funding for FOIA activities and agencies, as the $700 billion bill I showed you demonstrates that the government spends money on what the government decides it wants to spend money on. And so there's not any theoretical reason that we don't have adequate funding for FOIA activities and agencies. That's a policy decision that's made. And so that's a decision that may want to be put on the agenda as to whether we need additional funding for FOIA disclosure activities. We've discussed use of information technology to expand the public participation. Groups are concerned about Exemption 3 statutes proliferating, the Exemption 3 that refers to other statutes, and they'd like to have a provision to make it more difficult to add Exemption 3 exemptions. There have been a number of laws that have gone through with exemptions that weren't caught at the time they were going through. And this could become a way in which the FOIA could just disappear by legislative action that no one really knew at the time. And so there are concerns about curbing that. There are concerns about Executive Office of the President components and which ones are subject to disclosure and which ones are not. There's the issue out of the Open Government Act of 2007 about the Office of Government Information Services that has not been set up at NARA, National Archives, and there, as you heard this morning, there's sentiment that that should happen. And there's a proposal for an advisory committee on backlogs and delays as a way to address possibly some of the backlog and delay problems. So in concluding, my message to you is that I believe the United States was very much a leader in open government when we adopted the FOIA in 1966. And I think it's put our country in a state of what our values were, what our position was. I think in the intervening time, there have been changes that other countries have been able to come up with, innovations in some cases. We may not have the best functioning system at this point. We may not have the best functioning system we want to have at this point, and that we ought to be considering not just resting on our laurels of being a leader in this process in 1966, but we may want to consider as we go forward how we can perfect and improve our system and make it work in a way that citizens find it to be user-friendly and provides them information that they need in their decisions. And that's my message for you here today.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and enjoyed very much your presentation, which allows me to get to some things that I wanted to talk about with all of you. I'm Hugo Teufel. I'm the Chief Privacy Officer and Chief FOIA Officer at the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm a 1990 graduate of Washington College of Law. Professor Vaughn was my torts professor, and he's probably remembering back 21 years ago when I was in his class.
Wasn't that long ago, I'm sure.
I'm convinced it wasn't, too. So it's great to be here. Of course, when I was in law school, we were in a dingy building over on the main campus, and we as students at that time were complaining that we were having to pay extra money for a law school that we never thought was going to be built or acquired. So I'm glad that you all have finally gotten the law school, the building, the infrastructure that you needed to have.
And we're glad to have you here.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
To get what you paid for.
Yeah, and I know that the school has picked up a number of folks who had been at the Administrative Conference of the United States, which was where we got a lot of our articles. During the 10 years that the Administrative Law Journal was up and running independently, it's since been merged into the Administrative Law Review. And if I'm talking fast, it's a little litigator's technique. I've got a limited amount of time, and so I want to make sure I get everything in, so I'll talk fast. Plus, I had a really big Diet Coke before I got up here, so it's the caffeine. In addition to the other things that you mentioned about me, I had been Associate Solicitor for General Law at Department of the Interior and Associate General Counsel for General Law at Homeland Security, and I had responsibility for the provision of the legal advice on Freedom of Information and Privacy Act matters. And when I was Deputy Solicitor General under Gail Norton in the state of Colorado, I had certain Colorado Administrative Procedure Act responsibilities, and also drafted the, at that time, interpretive regulations for the Colorado Open Records Act, as well as guidance on the Criminal Justice Records Act. So I've got some experience from different perspectives, including the private sector, which I won't get into. But we're here to talk about transparency, and so what I want to do is spend a little time sharing with you some of my experiences as Chief Privacy Officer with respect to transparency and our interactions with the Europeans on various cross-border information and data sharing initiatives. So, but before getting to that, transparency, what does it mean to me as a government official who has responsibility for FOIA and privacy policy and the Privacy Act? Mm-hmm. So for me, what transparency comes down to is establishing trust and confidence in the public, in the American public. If you've done it right, the American public trusts what you're doing as a government agency and has confidence that you're doing it correctly and using information, often their personally identifiable information, correctly. It has another role, which is to allow the public to make informed decisions so that it can better advise its elected officials of their views, so that the elected officials can therefore take appropriate courses of action in the various state legislatures and in Congress. And so for me, when I think about transparency, that's really what it's about. So, you know, we often hear about the differences between the U.S. and other countries, and often the United States is criticized. And I won't say that criticism isn't sometimes necessary or certainly even appropriate, but I think it's important to talk about the differences in the way we view government. And say the Europeans, which is who I've been dealing with a lot over the last couple of years. And I should tell you that I'm a little under the weather because I was in Brussels for meetings with the European Commission and some MEPs, members of European Parliament, on Wednesday and Thursday, and then we went up to The Hague for meetings with the Ministry of Justice and Europol. To talk about these issues. And of course, whenever I travel, yeah, everybody thinks European travel is fun. Well, if you're making 8-hour flights over 4 days and you're not, and you never get over your jet lag and you're going nonstop, and yeah, it ain't vacation, I'm telling you. And then you get sick and then you're at WCL talking. So you need to think about the differences in how we view government, and they're fundamental differences. And they're important when you're talking about transparency and when you're thinking about critiques of the different systems. So let me start with the U.S. system. How were we founded? We were founded by people who had profound distrust of government. And so they wanted to make sure that the power of government, the coercive power of government, was spread not just in three branches at the federal level, but also was spread to the states and to individuals. And that's important because the founders of this country understood that if you allow too much power to accrete in any one aspect of government, that abuse is likely to occur. The Europeans, notwithstanding their experiences in the Second World War, and that includes even the Germans, who, when I say this as a person of German-American descent, you would think the Germans would know better, and they have the strongest privacy laws, and as individuals, they tend to take privacy far more seriously than anyone else. The Europeans, notwithstanding World War II, trust government. Now, if it's a commercial enterprise, those are the bad guys, and you have to regulate them very closely and carefully, and you never know what they're doing with your information. But government, on the other hand, government's a good thing, and they trust government. And so, if you delve deeply into what it is that European governments do in the area of justice and home affairs issues, if you're familiar with the way the Europeans talk, maybe the better way to describe it would be law enforcement and security issues. And I mean deeply, not superficially, unfortunately, as many Americans who have written about the subject have done. And I'll give you one example, and that's my good friend, Professor James O'Reilly, who we published 20 some years ago when I was on the Law Journal. And in fact, we just had come out to speak at my office last week, and also he spoke to the American Society of Access Professionals, ASAP. By the way, a plug for ASAP. I'm a vice president in ASAP, and it's a great organization, and I encourage you to get active and involved with ASAP wherever you are in government or in the private sector or with an NGO. It really is amazing how much information that the European law enforcement and security entities have, the things that they do with that, and the utter lack of transparency that exists. And so I want to talk to you about that a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit more first about the American system. So we have this fundamental distrust of government. We have power distributed about, and we have this concept of individual rights. I know the Europeans fundamental human rights, but we have individual rights, and that's important because any citizen can enforce his or her rights personally and can go in and seek redress in courts of the United States. And that right of redress is far more individualized than is sometimes the case in Europe, where bureaucracies, whether it's an ombudsman or a data protection authority, is looking into the issues and then might report back to the citizen on whether that person's rights were violated. And I've mentioned that, well, and there are multiple levels of oversight. There's a great paper that my deputy, John Croft, who wrote for the World Data Protection Reporter, I think that's the right publication. The article is on the networked and layered approach to privacy protection and oversight in the U.S. government. And by that, and I'm talking about privacy, but really privacy and FOIA, the public's ability to interact with government and government's ability to protect individual information on individuals, really they're very close. Privacy and disclosure are flip sides of a coin. So I may go back and forth, but there is relevance to the information. So if you look at John's article, you will see that we don't have the clean, neat, organized system of oversight that the Europeans do, but we have a much messier, much more layered approach. And so you've got increasingly over the last few years after the Homeland Security Act of 2002 and the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act 2004 with respect to ODNI, Office of the Director of National Intelligence, some 2005 Appropriations Acts, and then the 9/11 Commission Report Act of 2007. All of these laws have passed and require that agencies, various agencies that some might categorize as first-tier federal cabinet-level agencies, have privacy or civil liberties officers. So you've got privacy and civil liberties officers in the various agencies of varying degrees of interaction within their department and competence and capability. And not to say that none of them is competent or incapable, but frankly, some offices are better than others, and I would humbly suggest that the folks in my office do privacy and freedom of information disclosure better than any other government agency in the United States government. So you've got that. You've got inspector generals who have very, very broad authority, and whatever you feel about the Inspector General Act of 1978 and whether it's constitutional and violates the separation of powers doctrine, they exist and they're out there and they have a lot of authority. And you have the Government Accountability Office, which has a tremendous amount of reach. And then, of course, you've got the various committees of both houses that can and should, and especially over the last 2 years, have done a significant amount of oversight. I've probably testified now 7 times before either the House or the Senate, and those are in open sessions, not classified briefings or classified hearings that I've done. And so, but beyond that, you've got citizens, regular citizens, and non-governmental organizations who aren't tied to the government, who have no reason to view things with a particular mindset, but stand outside and act as the real watchdogs of government to ensure that government does what it's supposed to be doing and doesn't do the things that it shouldn't be doing. And so in contrast, when we look at the EU, I say EU, when we look at Europeans, because it could be EU, non-EU, it could be Schengen, non-Schengen, not all of the European countries are in the European Union or part of Schengen. Norway is in some, but not in others. Switzerland is not in the EU, but it is under Schengen. There is often a similarity in the way things are done, and the most striking examples are, of course, that within government there isn't that much oversight, or I'm sorry, there isn't that much transparency, though there are some wonderful structures that exist. I mentioned to you the independent data protection authorities that are part of the parliaments. Some countries have ombudsmen, but most significantly there are very few non-governmental organizations that exist within Europe that look to make sure that government isn't doing what it shouldn't be doing. I mean, the two that come to mind are Privacy International and State Watch, but there are not a lot of others out there. And frankly, that's unfortunate because, I mean, I'm in government. Pretty soon, with the change of administration, I'll be going back into the private sector looking for a job. And so By not being a long-term career government servant, my views on disclosure and transparency and privacy, data protection, aren't colored just by my experiences in government, even if I have had, I can't believe it now, over 10 years of federal experience over the course of my life, but are also colored by my experiences as a state government official and also as someone in the private sector who's represented clients, both for public interest reasons as well as because they were paying clients who were commercial entities. But there tends to be, I would argue, that whether you're in an independent ombudsman's office or data protection authority's office, or in parliament, or in an interior ministry or justice ministry, there will be in you some bias in favor of government because that's where you get your paycheck. And I don't care what party you're in or what country you're in, there is. And so one of the great things about the U.S. system of oversight is that there are private individuals and non-governmental organizations who will vindicate the rights of themselves and their fellow citizens to make sure that government acts correctly. And you just don't have that in Europe. No matter how wonderful people think Europe is, it really doesn't have the really rich, in-depth structures that we have to make sure that government isn't doing bad things. And so where this has come up for me lately has been in the context of the automated targeting system, which is the Customs and Border Protection system, if you will, under the Privacy Act of 1974. Systems that have records on individuals are covered under the Privacy Act of 1974. This is the system. There is a system of records for this system. And what goes into that system? The passenger name record data of those who fly to and from the United States. And so if you've been following things over the last 4 years, there's been a lot of criticism about how the United States government has been collecting this information and what it does for this information, and whether it should be doing these sorts of things. So two things that I would say. First, it's nothing new. If you go to ellisisland.org and you put in my name, because my name is the same as my father's and my grandfather's, with the exception of the suffix, you will find that Hugo Teufel came over in 1923 from Stuttgart, and there are about 30-odd pieces of information on the ship's manifest that was provided to the predecessor of INS, which is now the tri-bureaus at the Department of Customs and Border Protection, Citizenship and Immigration Services, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And that information was not provided because my grandfather was immigrating to the United States. That information was provided because the United States, exercising a fundamental aspect of its sovereignty, was making sure that the people who came into the United States weren't bad guys and weren't here to do bad things. And so they collected certain pieces of personally identifiable information so that they could verify that this was not one of those bad guys. And yes, we didn't have fiber optics and we didn't have satellites, but we had cable transmissions on telegraphs, and occasionally the Europeans would cable to let the Americans know that a bad guy was on the loose and was probably on his way over to the United States and might be coming through Ellis Island to do harm or to escape his just rewards back in somewhere in Europe. So this isn't anything new. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is to take this back a level, to look at the abstract, from a more abstract perspective, and what is it that we're doing here? It is the commercial collection of data, in this case by airlines, the commercial collection of data that is personally identifiable for law enforcement or security purposes, in this case to be used by Customs and Border Protection to make sure that the bad guys aren't coming in. And unlike in the 1920s when my grandfather came here as a 19-year-old who had probably been a ne'er-do-well back in Stuttgart but was able to come to the United States and have a second chance at things, the bad guys don't wait until they get off the boat before they do bad things. Sometimes bad guys like to do bad things on the planes as they're flying over oceans in order to make political and other and ideological points. And so it's necessary to have that information before people come over. But it's functionally, it's the commercial collection of personally identifiable information for security purposes. And so we thought in my office, okay, we need to better understand how the Europeans work. What does this mean, and what examples are there where we could look to see how Europeans handle this information? And so we thought about the recent requirements for data retention with respect to ISPs for a year or 2 years for law enforcement purposes. We thought about various financial aspects, and by the way, I had nothing to do with SWIFT. That was Department of Treasury. In case you're going to ask me those questions, that ain't us. It was Treasury. But whenever you take out a certain amount of money over a particular dollar or euro amount, that has to be reported back to a ministry or the Department of Treasury here. So we looked at those things and we thought about it, and we talked to some folks in the financial industry, and we thought, no, there's got to be something else that's a little more analogous to PNR data. And of course, the thing that came to mind was a thing I first experienced when I visited Germany in 1984. And of course, that's hotel registration information. If you've been to Europe, and I suspect many of you have, you may or may not have realized it, but your personally identifiable information, including perhaps, depending upon the country that you attended, that you visited, your passport number would have been collected. Maybe you got a notice, maybe you didn't get a notice, and then that information for centuries, in fact, would have been provided in hard copy format to the local law enforcement authorities. Of course, if you know the European countries, the local law enforcement authorities are usually regional offices of a national police force. And so your hotel registration information often goes to the national police force. Where does it go? So back in May of last year, my colleague Jane Horvath, who was the Department of Justice Privacy and Civil Liberties Officer, sent a couple of letters, first to Peter Hustings, the European Data Protection Supervisor, and then to the Belgian Data Protection Authority to try and get answers. Now keep in mind, we're government officials. These are official government letters on government stationery, and we're asking these questions in furtherance of our official responsibilities. And we, and by we, in this case I mean the United States government and the European Commission, European Union, have been having ongoing discussions to include the high-level contact group over a period of time. We didn't get answers. We wrote some more letters, including to the Dutch Data Protection Authority, some ministries of the interior, the Portuguese and the Spanish, the German Data Protection Authority, Article 29 Working Group, and others. And frankly, and I'm going to move forward because we're running out of time, over the course of a year, we got a handful of responses, and some folks, in particular ministries of the interior, felt that they had better things to do than to answer our letters. So what does that say to me as a government official? I don't take it personally. But if I, the chief privacy officer at the Department of Homeland Security, can't get answers as to how systems work, how information is collected, what is used with that information, how long it's retained, who it's shared with, then what can you as American citizens, I assume you're all American, maybe you're not, maybe you may be from other parts of the country, but citizens of the world, if that makes you feel better, you know, what's the likelihood that you're going to get answers from the Europeans about these questions about how this information is being used? And so it has troubled me, but of course, the important thing to remember here is we live in liberal democracies, at least in the United States and Europe, and so often, much to the chagrin of governments, there is not necessarily a monopoly on information. And we've been able to go to other sources in the private sector who've been able to provide us information. And so without revealing things that I'm not necessarily yet ready to reveal because we may want to issue a public report, you know, ask yourself, are there any countries where this information is collected electronically and then electronically transmitted overnight, every night, to national police forces in the various countries that you may visit in Europe? How long is that information kept? What other sorts of things might European governments be doing with your personally identifiable information? For instance, in the case of the Netherlands, how many wiretaps do you think go on in a given day in the Netherlands? And compare that to the number of wiretaps that go on at the federal level in the United States government in the course of a year. Would you think that number would be higher with respect to the Dutch or higher with respect annually to the U.S. government? You might be surprised at what you find out. And so when we have asked our European colleagues about these things, often what we hear from them as well, we have a data protection directive. We have an ombudsman. We have a data protection authority. It's okay. But is it really okay if you can't actually, if you don't know what the laws are, if you don't know where to write to, if it's not clear what your means of redress are? And with that, I'll stop and say thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here. Wow. And one thing I would note with respect to the automated targeting system, we have a privacy impact assessment. It's, I don't know, 20-some pages long. It's up on our website. Anybody can take a look at it. It tells you what the potential privacy risks are. It tells you how we're using the information, what we've collected, why we've collected, what we're doing with it. We also have a system of records notice that's up on the website for the automated targeting system, and all of that information is publicly available. In contrast to the Europeans and the information that they collect with respect to hotel registration information, beyond the Schengen Acquis Article 45, which says that every country in Schengen can do that. Thank you.
Thank you to you both, Dan and Hugo. You're bringing us in almost on time, and if we can delay a little bit your reunion with your former torts professor, Professor Vaughn, who wanted to say just a few words by way of concluding remarks. So everyone, I think, should know Professor Vaughn, who not only is a long-term member of the faculty here at the Washington College of Law, but yes, indeed, is the same Vaughn as in Vaughn Declaration, to be sure. Professor Vaughn.
Thank you. It's my honor to be able to close this conference with some general comments about the program that's been presented today. And Dr. Martin Luther King observed that a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And today's celebration of the international right to know confirms the universal foundation of this right and its increasing global length, reach. From half a dozen countries in 1980 to over 70 today, with a dozen others ready to join this community. This celebration also cautions that secrecy anywhere reduces the right to know elsewhere. We learn of risks in America from disclosures in China. Japanese purchases of American pharmaceutical products uncover dangers in those products through requests to the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. Indeed, the right to know has been expressly linked to human right of freedom of expression. In Marcel Reyes versus Chile, the International Court on Human Rights found that the right to acquire information from government is protected by the provision regarding freedom of expression in the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights. This conference demonstrates that universal concerns, including human rights, democratic accountability, public health and safety, and attacks on corruption, may be applied in ways that consider various political and cultural heritages. Universality does not require uniformity. Variances in the character of exemptions, in the scope of requirements, and of the techniques of enforcement illustrate the application of universal principles in different settings. This conference also reminds us that we have very much to learn from the experiences that arise in these different settings. Each of us, in choosing what provisions fit our circumstances, have many examples on which to draw. Here in the United States, we draw on the experiences of others to evaluate our own system of open government. Finally, this conference alerts us that the right to know did not begin with government and does not rest solely in its hands. The spread of non-governmental organizations, now often of international scope, provide support for the right to know. These NGOs also provide networks through which freedom of information acquired through freedom of information provisions can be disseminated quickly throughout the world. These organizations, armed with new technologies, suggest another more optimistic modification of Dr. King's warning. And that more optimistic modification is the end of secrecy anywhere threatens secrecy everywhere.
Well, thank you everyone again for your attendance and your close attention, and we'll look forward to perhaps seeing you next year on the same International Right to Know Celebration Day. Well, thank you once again. Thank you.
That's always an advantage.